I remember in 2008, a Democrat became head of state. His party won the Congress too. Then we watched to see what they would do. Vague promises and hopeful signs, just try to read between the lines. These things take time, that's understood, and I know that patience can be good. And I'm no genius, but I'm not dumb, and I'm still waiting for the change to come. Many thought it had arrived. We felt lucky to have survived all those years of right-wing rule, using fear and hatred as the fuel. Now we're on the other side, and we're still swimming against the tide. The wars go on, good people die, missiles rain down from the sky. Once I dreamed you were my best chum, but I'm still waiting for the change to come. The prisons fill up with the poor, victims of the same drug war. Bankers fly in first-class seats while families move into the streets. Across the country, schools close down. In another bankrupt town, oil sits on the seafloor, and now you want to drill for more. And like everybody where I'm from, I'm still waiting for the change to come. I don't know, but I'd like to think we can pull each other from the brink. I've heard it said with a sigh, this nation is too young to die. But the system's broke, and what I glean is change must come by other means. Can you hear the whispers in the air that what we need is Tahrir Square? Until then, in Washington, I'll be waiting for the change to come. Still waiting for the change to come.
Welcome to Great Speeches and Interviews on Axis Sacramento and The Voice. I'm Steve Lerman. You can hear today's program at 96.5 FM in the Sacramento area. And today's program is America's Path to Permanent War. Andrew Basevich, an international relations professor at Boston University, says now is the time to examine the Washington consensus on national security. He argues that national priorities must shift from fixing Afghanistan to fixing Detroit.
I know I speak for all of us gathered here to say how much we always look forward to having Professor Basevich address us. With each one of his publications, Professor Basevich knows how to engage us to think about the important topics of the day. That being said, when you leave here this afternoon, you too may find that what's on his mind may be on yours, as it will become difficult to ignore his argument and contentions about U.S. foreign policy and U.S. militarism. In Washington Rules, America's Path to Permanent War, Professor Basevich writes that in thinking about his own life and his time as a military officer, he realized that American power, policies, and purpose were bound together in a consistent package, each element drawing strength and reinforcement from each other, but not always to a productive end. This was especially true during the Cold War. Yet, at the end of the Cold War, which just so happened to coincide with the end of his military career, he found that the familiar narrative about our national security was no longer viable. Instead, he discovered perplexing riddles about U.S. military practices to find the answers to what he viewed as contradictions and misperceptions about the threats posed by American adversaries, our speaker set out on an intellectual journey to critically analyze the past. No longer a soldier, and with the independence of a scholar, Professor Bacevich began to examine the past 60 years of U.S. military policy. He found a disturbing pattern of U.S. military practice that committed us to a permanent national security crisis. The evidence is as follows: a policy which reveals an abiding conviction that the minimum essential for international peace and order requires the United States and us alone to maintain a global military presence around the world. We design our forces to project global power so that we are ready to intervene anywhere at any time according to the way we believe the international order should work. From the expansionist era of Sachs General Curtis LeMay and CIA Director Alan Dulles through successive governments since World War II, Professor Bacevich challenges these basic precepts of power, presence, and intervention to demonstrate that these ideas are neither a Democrat or a Republican approach to military policy, but a government institutional model that all presidents have bought into. He argues that this practice has benefited the political, military, and business establishment while doing little for the country's security or domestic prosperity. The world today looks different than it did just a decade ago, yet for the past 60 years, the basic assumptions of America's military policy have remained unchanged. Professor Bacevich says that while these policies might have made some sense in 1945, today the so-called Washington rules have relegated America to a condition of permanent national security crisis approximating perpetual war. Attempting to prolong its existence might serve Washington's interests, but it will not serve the interests of the American people. If you are interested in our national security and the future of our country, you will not find a more persuasive argument for changing our country's direction. Please join me in welcoming a man not afraid to challenge conventional wisdom and talk about issues. Our guest today, Andrew Bacevich.
Well, thank you very much for this opportunity to speak to you today. I'm very grateful for that. My plan is to speak fairly briefly because my experience is that on occasions such as this, you're only pretending to come because you want to hear me. You're actually coming because you have something important to say. But quite seriously, I do think that it is in the discussion and the exchange that I know I have more fun, and I suspect that you have fun as well. I'll also speak briefly because actually the content of the talk is a summary of the book, which you've just heard, incredibly competently and more succinctly than I was going to offer. The object of the exercise really was I was going to try to tell you what the book is about, hoping that you wouldn't say at the end of the talk, well, I got that, now I understand, so there's no need for me to look at the book. The object of the exercise was to sort of tickle you and tease you and to have you say at the end of the talk, oh, I must not only buy that, but I have to buy multiple copies for all of my grandchildren and my neighbors, for my book club, the Manhattan Book Club, the Oprah Book Club. Oprah, are you out there? So, two questions. The first, a question that I think is on many of our minds. The second, a question that still haunts, I think, people of my generation, maybe many of you here. The first question is, why are we in Afghanistan? And the second question is, why were we in Vietnam? Two questions, I think, one answer. We are in Afghanistan, we were in Vietnam, because Washington stubbornly adheres to a national security consensus consisting of two points. I'm going to give you those points. But before I do, it was fun talking to Mr. Barnett here during the period before the luncheon. Mr. Barnett, who seems amazing, worked during World War II for the Chief of Naval Operations, Admiral Ernest King, a remarkable figure, frankly, largely forgotten in our history, sad to say. And what occurred to me as I was sitting here having my lunch is, although I think there is a common answer to why we were in Vietnam and why we are in Afghanistan, the same answer does not apply to why we fought World War II. And the point I want to make in saying that is that this national security consensus, which I will attempt to describe and that I will decry, is certainly something that has existed for a considerable period of time now, I think since the very beginning of the Cold War. But that doesn't mean it existed forever. There was a time when Americans chose to go to war or chose not to go to war based on a series of considerations, based on an analysis that was not determined by some sort of preset set of assumptions or convictions. And I think it's important for us to remember that. It is not as if a great power is condemned to continue to follow a certain path. I mean, were that to be the case, why be a great power? There was a time when a core conviction informing our approach to foreign policy and national security policy is that we ought to determine our own fate based on a sober calculation of what serves the interests of the American people. So that was kind of a long parenthetical comment. And let me go back to the text.
Axis Sacramento broadcasts great speeches and interviews every Sunday from 6 to 8 p.m., or you can get the podcast at greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. I am a member of the interim Iraqi government. I'm sure you heard that our recent elections went very well. Of course, there were a surprisingly large number of votes for Pat Buchanan, but that's neither here nor there. Everything was fine. My first official action, of course, was to go and have my state sponsor physical. The doctor performed some tests and told me I have 6 months to live. And I told him, woohoo! You know, 6 months. I mean, it's a lot longer than most people in the Iraqi government can look forward to, so I've got that going for me. Anyway, tonight I'm here in my capacity as the Iraqi Minister for Tourism. And in an effort to bring more Americans to our lovely country, I've decided to do away with our old slogan, which was, death to the great Satan! In favor of something more family-friendly and hip in what's happening, like what happens in Fallujah stays in Fallujah. Perhaps it would sound better in a song. Won't you come and tour Iraq? See the land that's so Islami. Life can be so sweet on the sunny side of Tikrit. If you hear a loud attack, we'll just say the weather's balmy. Maybe we should meet on the Sunni side of the street. Let's all go walking at noon, where the streets are all strewn like a Flintstones cartoon. We've trouble with rubble. Maybe soon we'll have some luck and things won't be so Saddam-y. Our state bird is the duck on the sunny side. Better run inside, get my gun and hide in Tikrit. You'll come back now, you hear?
And now back to Andrew Bacevich and America's Path to Permanent War.
So two questions, one answer. The answer is a national security consensus. Let me try to describe that consensus and its two main elements. The first I call in the book the American Credo. And the American Credo is an effort to define purpose of national security policy. And the second element I call in the book the Sacred Trinity. The Sacred Trinity defines practice. The claim made by the American Credo is that we are summoned. The United States is summoned. And the United States alone is summoned to lead, save, liberate, and ultimately transform the world. I teach a course at Boston University called Ideas in American Foreign Policy. It's my absolute, total, complete favorite course that I teach. And what we do in this course is to, we don't use textbooks. What we do is to invite, encourage, even insist that our students, my students, will read a set of documents which I have chosen, documents which, this is kind of the conceit of the course, either have shaped the way we think about foreign policy or has shaped the critique that evolves relative to foreign policy. And the very first document that we read in this course is the sermon given on the decks of the good ship Arabella in 1630 off the coast of a place that is about to become Boston by John Winthrop, describing the purpose of this community that he, as the leader of this small group of people, is about to found in what is about to become New England, what is going to be the Massachusetts Bay Colony. And of course, he begins by saying, by insisting that the purpose of this community is determined by a covenant between the community and God himself, and that what God commands and what God expects is that this community will serve as a city upon a hill. That famous phrase of John Winthrop's, which, of course, periodically gets revived in our political discourse, and in many respects, I think, holds the absolute key to understanding the basis of how we define our relations to the rest of the world. That we are called upon. We are chosen. If you're a believer, chosen by God. If you're not a believer, chosen by providence or chosen by history. And that our purpose is ultimately a redeeming purpose. This understanding of purpose, this American credo, expressed in different words at different times by different leaders, I think has to be understood as, in some respects, the absolute foundation of this national security consensus that I try to describe. But there's that second piece, the Sacred Trinity. And according to the Sacred Trinity, the minimum essentials of international peace and order require the United States, and we have to emphasize, again, the United States alone, to maintain a global military presence, to configure our forces not to defend the country. For the Pentagon, the defense of the United States of America proper actually serves very much as an afterthought. That's why after 9/11, we had to create a whole other cabinet department called the Department of Homeland Security to defend the country. We can configure our forces not to defend the country, but to provide instruments for global power projection. Global military presence, forces configured for global power projection. These two married together to provide the third element of the Sacred Trinity, namely support for policies that rely on a pattern of global interventionism. Now, together, Credo and Trinity constitute the essence of the way that Washington, and by Washington here I really mean our governing classes, the institutions and people that in one way or another have the ability to sort of reach out and put their thumb on the helm that drives the ship of state. Credo and Trinity constitute the essence of the way that Washington has attempted to govern and to police what Henry Luce dubbed back in 1941 the American century. The Sacred Trinity lends plausibility to the Credo's vast claims. The Credo justifies the Trinity's vast requirements and vast exertions. Together, Credo and Trinity define the rules to which Washington adheres, and they determine the precepts by which Washington has attempted and still attempts to rule. Yet there's a problem. And the problem is that the rules don't work. At least they don't work any longer. Indeed, blind adherence to the Washington rules is proving to be counterproductive, something that events, I think, have made increasingly apparent since 9/11. Promising American safety and security, the Washington rules have produced something akin to permanent war. We are all aflutter because the latest Bob Woodward blockbuster is about to be conferred upon a grateful public. And so all the media is chattering. I guess today the verb would be twittering with excerpts from this book. And one of the excerpts that I've seen in print, or in electrons, I guess, is the comment. Woodward quotes General Petraeus. I didn't write the quote down, so I won't get this exactly right, but it's about 95% right. And Petraeus is quoted as saying, I'm not sure the context, whether he's referring to Afghanistan specifically or sort of the larger conflict with al-Qaeda. But he's quoted as saying, you're nodding your head, you saw this, we can't win this war. We can't win this war. This is the commanding general of the war. We can't win this war. But this is the kind of fight, I think he refers in the quote, this is the kind of fight that we will be engaged in for years to come and that our kids will be engaged in. Extraordinary statement. Why would one wage a war that you can't win? Why would one wage a war that you fully anticipate is going to last, apparently, for generations? The only reason I can imagine that you would do that is if you concluded that there absolutely was no way of avoiding that prospect, that there was no alternative, that there was no other choice. But then you have to scratch your head. How could it be that there is no alternative, that there is no other choice? To what degree has anybody in Washington tried to find an alternative? Or is it too inconvenient, too contrary to existing interests, to actually try to discern whether there is an alternative? So promising American safety and security, the Washington rules have produced something akin to permanent war, promising to preserve the American way of life. I mean, we are told that this enterprise is about preserving the American way of life. The Washington rules have set the United States on a course toward bankruptcy, both fiscal and moral.
Guns, lay down your arms, give up the power. time to live and let die. And you can't get another try. Something inside this heart has died. You're a ruin.
Now for something completely different.